And we may do the final episode live on location from Avery Salvage Yard.
Oh, shit. That's a great idea. Hey, we have a contact now. You think we can
go out there
and set up, take a couple microphones?
Well, yeah, we might be able to.
That would be fun. The Avery sign behind us, that Salvage Yard sign, that would be cool.
That would be killer.
That would be killer. That's funny.
Oh,
said,
my
killer.
God. I can't believe I used that word.
I want you to put your hands together. And welcome to the stage. Big round of applause.
All right, welcome back to the Smokescreen Podcast, episode 58.
Yes.
And again, take two.
Take two.
Because we just tried this for 30 minutes and lost all our audio and video. Thank you.
But it was a good one.
It really was.
We were killing it.
But, I mean, at least we're laughing about it now because I was, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're back this week talking Making a Murderer.
Yes.
/ Convicting a Murderer, more specifically.
Right.
And I'm really excited because before we get into that, you know, the next couple episodes that we covered 1 through 5 in the first podcast a couple weeks ago, we do have some exciting news.
I'm so pumped.
So next podcast, and this is 99.9%, like I said before,
mm-hmm.
we have a special guest coming up related to Convicting a Murderer. So be sure to stay tuned for that. We'll let you know what's going on. Be sure to subscribe if you're on YouTube. And we'll have somebody very close to Convicting a Murderer on as a special guest.
Yes,
and can't wait for that one as well to get his insight.
Me either.
Into all this stuff. So anyway, a couple weeks ago, we brought back out Making a Murderer since Convicting a Murderer came out and talked about the first half of the season, episodes 1 through 5, and all the big things we did not see in Making a Murderer. And this is really captivating people out there, bringing all this stuff back up again. And I mentioned before, just to mention it again, because I feel like I'm going to repeat myself everything you say. You know, we are talking about a true crime thing here. Teresa Halbach was the victim here, no matter what you believe, as far as the two sides, everything, the truthers and the guilters and the whole thing. Yeah. We're trying to remain neutral. We don't want to be put in a box. We have questions about everything still, but this is definitely changing some things that we were deceived.
We were.
By Making a Murderer. No doubt about it.
Unfortunately, too.
Yes.
Because I was a big fan of those filmmakers.
Yeah, I was. And now I'm seeing that it was a story to some degree, to mm-hmm. a big degree, I should say.
Yeah.
A lot of things edited, changed. So real quick, too, I know this somehow gets political. There'll be a couple comments. Can't watch it. Daily Wire.
Yes.
We understand that. Look. If you're really interested in this case, do yourself a favor and watch this regardless to get the full story. And again, you'll never know the full story. This case will never be solved to a T. There will never be a clean, here's exactly what happened that night on the 31st of October, you know, 2005 or whatever. But these are just undisputable facts.
It is.
And I think it needs to be explored.
If you really got tied up in that Making a Murderer or Making a Murderer season 2,
yeah,
really, you know, were just found yourself binging them, cheering, you know, saying give those guys another trial, even free them, you know,
yeah.
A lot of people felt that way. How you couldn't want to hear that potentially you were duped,
right?
And see what people are talking about, you know, for yourself. That surprises me. That I just separate yourself from, like you said, anything political, and just give it a shot. Because this was not made with any. It wasn't made by Daily Wire.
No, I mean, it was acquired by Daily Wire. It's a very important point to make. Candace Owens does host it. She inserts herself as kind of the host, but mm-hmm. she's not really in it a lot. She makes a few statements, gives her opinions.
Yes.
You can agree or disagree, but don't not watch it just because it comes from some source that you may not like or whatever, which I don't understand any of this stuff. I feel like if anybody with common sense should hear both sides of everything.
Yeah.
But this is not a political documentary. This is about a true crime that we were at least partially deceived about from Netflix and Making a Murderer, because they left out so much stuff. So,
and if you don't, I mean, we're going to try to at least highlight a lot of the things that they did on there. So, you know, we'll do our best.
Yeah, but and we'll, like I said before in the previous take, you know, I mean, we'll play devil's advocate on both sides, you know, little what ifs, whatever, and our opinions on things, because, you know, it doesn't. So, in other words, it doesn't mean if I'm saying that this was definitely, you know, edited by the creators of Making a Murderer, it doesn't mean he's innocent.
No,
you
know, that's right.
It's just we're going to go through everything we possibly can. Obviously, not every little single thing, but like you mentioned before, say that again. If as far as the people who Mace comment, you can't change my mind. We already knew all this stuff.
Yes, yeah.
It's just
I see those comments, and they're like, "Big deal. We already knew he was a bad guy. That's not this series isn't showing us anything new." That tells me, you've only seen episode one.
You've only seen the free episode on YouTube or Twitter. Or whatever. Yep. Because we did say that. We said that before watching Convicting a Murderer. There's nothing you can tell me that's going to change my mind about this. We know he's a bad guy. We said it in our podcast 2 years ago. We said it last week in our podcast.
Yes.
Anybody that throws an animal on a fire, or whether you're trying to miss the fire, you're an asshole. You're a bad person. But we're talking about a separate murder case here.
We are.
So you just, you know, at least be, we're just, you know, we're trying to remain neutral but open-minded to both sides. There's still questions all around.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't want to see this or don't want to accept some of the things just because you think that the Convicting a Murderer people are carrying their own narrative, because that's what I keep seeing. I've watched some other videos.
I have too.
I'm trying to stay abreast and fair and listen to all sides. And that's what they'll say. It's the main kind of theme in these videos is we already knew this stuff. We knew he's a bad person. They're just it's just a character assassination or a revelation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make him a murderer. No, it doesn't.
Right.
But a lot more is in it than that.
Even during episode one of Convicting a Murderer, you and I were saying, damn, that is bad. That is bad. But it doesn't, this is nothing new. This isn't groundbreaking to me.
Get to the evidence.
That's what we kept saying.
We're getting to the evidence.
We are. And so, it hits hard.
It does. So the last podcast, or 2 weeks ago, whatever, we did kind of a mid-season review, episodes 1-5, went through some of that stuff. So check that one out, because we're going through like all the big things in some detail. As far as, you know, what was cut out, what was missed, and what the full story is when you kind of combine these two together as a full narrative. Yeah. And again, we'll never get the perfect, clear, crystal clear vision of what happened that night. So that's just not going to happen. And only the murderer, whoever that is, and God, that's if you believe in God or any of that stuff, knows. So hopefully, the full truth will come to light to some degree.
Yes.
But anyway, anything else before we jump back in again to episodes 6 and 7? I don't know. Did we just mention we did, you know, full disclosure, we did receive screeners for the full season. We cannot talk about anything that's not been public yet, and which goes into, again, our special guest coming up in the, hopefully next week. I'm really excited about that. So we have seen beyond episode 7, but we're not going to spoil anything. Leave it for you guys to make up your own minds, that type of thing. So we're going over basically episodes 6 and 7 since we did like 1-5.
Full disclosure.
Yeah.
I've watched beyond episode 7 twice now.
There you go. I have not. I have not, but we definitely will. We'll definitely be talking about this even after next week's. I'm sure we'll wrap this up after the finale. Maybe. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see.
We will.
We might have a couple more.
Yeah, we really might.
Yeah, because this is a pretty big thing right now, and there's just so much stuff you can't sit down in one podcast and have a 5-hour long discussion about every little thing.
And we may do the final episode live on location from Avery Salvage Yard.
Oh shit, that's a great idea. Hey, we have a contact now. You think we can
go out there
and set up, take a couple microphones?
Well, yeah, we might be able to.
That would be fun. The Avery sign behind us, that Salvage Yard sign, that would be cool.
That would be killer.
That would be killer. That's funny.
Oh my God, I can't believe I used that word.
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
No, it's just, see, Oh my God. Maybe this will be the better than the first take.
Maybe it will.
Okay. Anyway, let's jump right in. So, yeah, again, real quick, thank you guys for the recent support. It's cool having a podcast coming back every week. It's, you know, doing pretty well. It's definitely fun to do. We really enjoy these. And we're doing a lot of cool shorts now. They're out there. So, help us out. Give us a, you know, a rating on whatever podcast platform, and definitely subscribe on YouTube and all that good stuff.
That's something too that I haven't really told you since we've been doing these again. It's like it helps my midweek grind at work.
Yeah, yeah.
When you release these, I get really excited.
Right.
It comes right in the middle of the week. You know, I get to.
Yeah, and then we get to read comments,
AirPods on, yeah,
all that stuff as they pile up throughout the week. Yeah, at least last episode wasn't topical, so it's more of a Q&A fun thing. But it's hard to title that type of thing. So, but this is definitely one of those things that's a lot of people are following right now. And I have seen, to be fair, a lot of comments saying, "Yeah, I was duped." So there are people saying that, but there's still a lot of people in the so-called truther camp that just refuse to listen to any of this. And then there's other people who always thought it was trash. I mean, so we're just trying to be like, listen to both sides fair and in the middle and just go over the stuff and not trying to change anybody's mind. We'll give you our opinions for sure, but it's a lot, so much stuff, man.
If you're
so much stuff in this case,
a person who doesn't like the police,
yes, yeah,
who
glad you said that.
Wouldn't believe a word that came out of a cop's mouth, no matter what they're talking about, then some of the things we're going to talk about just aren't for you anyway.
But
if you're open-minded and you want to hear some of the other side a little bit on some of those gotcha moments in Making a Murderer,
right?
We really recommend watching it, but we're going to try to explain some of it to you.
Yeah.
Shed light on it.
Again, don't do yourself a disservice and not watch this because it's from some organization you don't like or whatever.
Please.
It's just really, if you're interested in this case, you'll want to hear this. Trust me.
Because we were just like everybody else.
Yeah.
When we watched 100%. It, we were pissed. He was framed.
100%.
He absolutely deserved another trial.
Absolutely.
In my mind.
Brandon Dassey had nothing to do with nothing.
Yeah.
All that stuff.
I could not imagine how two juries got something so wrong.
Yes.
I was blown
Ken
away.
Kratz is the devil.
Yes.
He may still be the devil some degree. But yeah. definitely, the cops, Colburn especially.
Yes.
Which, to get straight into episode 6, that's what it opens up with, is Colburn.
Yep.
So Colburn kind of coming off episode 5 where, he is now the bad guy. He's one of the villains of this story for sure. Him and Detective Link, I think it is, along with Fassbender and all the rest of the cops. They start by showing all the death threats he started getting. I mean, just how many, 20, was it like 24 hours full of recorded conversations? Yeah.
Over 24 hours
to his house and to his office and to the police department. I mean, from all over the world, and they said mostly it actually was international.
I mean,
literal threats of, I'll be waiting outside your house, like you said, with a rifle. I hope you do this in front of your kids. Do these horrible things.
Yeah, terrible.
Yeah, things. Horrible. So, we said we were watching some other videos and whatever, and the director, Sean, said that was part of his motivation was, there's real people here involved in this, and the wake that left people in real danger, honestly, and including, Colburn. So they used him as the biggest example because, of course, he's the one who called in the license plate, and we'll get to that, of course. But
think about this, Chris, when in Making a Murderer, there's a lot of clips of people from around, I guess maybe the world, but definitely around the United States, who have traveled there, stand outside on the courthouse steps.
Yes.
Picketing, yelling at passing cars. What's to say some lunatic wouldn't travel that far to do bad things?
100%.
If I was them, I would really be worried.
It's a fact. And that's the thing, man. You know, you got to remember, everybody's human.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you watch this thing and you came away, yeah, he's 100% these dirty cops, they deserve whatever. You know, hold on. That's what this is for. This is to kind of show the other side of things. So really, and of course, you know, again, they're playing all the calls, and, you know, he's mm-hmm. talking about how it affected him and his family. And I mean, you start to empathize a little bit with him as a person and not this stone cold cop killer, you know, cop who's a killer. So mm-hmm. I'm trying to say, who helped frame this innocent man twice and all this kind of stuff. So we talked about in the last podcast, you know, he had nothing to do with the previous case. He was not liable in that lawsuit like they made it out to be. So anyway, regardless what you think, as far as, you know, the key and all that kind of stuff, he just had nothing to do with the first case. And it's just a fact. There's no, you know, dispute,
right,
really. So if I can read my notes that I had scribbled through before, but the license plate calls the big
yes.
thing. So he calls in this license
it's
plate.
It's huge.
It was the big gotcha moment, one of many.
Yes.
Big gotcha moment.
Huge. Like you said, it was episode one.
Episode one.
Where he,
episode one.
One was the other thing we were talking about in the last one.
Do we have Stephen Avery in custody?
Yeah.
That was
the big
one.
I wanted to bring that up because we did fail to mention that on the last one. So is it cool to cover that now?
Go for it.
Because that bothered me that we forgot to mention that in our last podcast.
There's always that, oh shit, we forgot this in the podcast.
So in episode one of Making a Murder, it ends with this cliffhanger where you hear someone talking to dispatch and said, so do we have Stephen Avery in custody? And you're like, why in the hell would he ask that?
Why would he ask if we have Stephen Avery in custody?
Yeah. What you find out is during the course of this investigation, they had police out around the property. And everybody's seen the aerial views, all these roads going around this place. So they were stopping traffic. They had the road blocked, and they were stopping traffic of all the cars coming through and checking people's ID and checking them out.
Yeah, because you had locals had to go in, and they lived there in those areas.
And so what they found was when they ran somebody's ID, there was a hit on it, and it came back with there was a warrant, like a be-on-the-lookout warrant or something. And so they... Because there was that warrant, they had to take this person into custody.
Right.
So that went out over the radio that they were taking somebody into custody. And whoever that was on the episode one that called in, he knew that they were out there searching the salvage yard.
At the Avery's place specifically.
Yes, at the Avery's place. And they also knew that Stephen was... who they were looking at, because he was the last person that saw her.
Right.
When he heard that somebody was taken into custody, I mean, that's all he heard. So when he was talking to them, he said, so do they have Stephen Avery in custody? If they would have played a little bit longer,
yes,
she would have said, no, it was this and that. And he would have been like, oh, okay, I just heard somebody got arrested over there.
Right.
Like, he literally says this, but they don't play it long enough.
They just stop it.
Right.
Stop the tape.
So I thought that was a huge part.
And that was a big hook for episode one of Making Murder, because it went off with that. And it's like, oh, shit, they're after this dude again.
Mm-hmm.
He just got out of prison. What the hell? And that was immediate. And once you're – and that's what, like we said before, that's what can kind of conditions you for everything else, all this kind of setup.
It does.
To, you know, this horrible big conspiracy.
Yeah, they keep putting more layers on this onion.
Yes.
You know?
And you're just getting wrapped up, and it's emotional, and the music and all the editing we'll talk about as well. But Colburn, going back to him, obviously the big license plate call.
It was
so
huge.
As everybody knows, he calls in 2 or 3 days before the car is actually found. He calls in the dispatch and run this tag for me, reads off the tag number, and the dispatcher says, yep, that's belongs to Teresa Hallback, all that stuff. And then he says, okay, 1999 Toyota.
Yep.
Knew the make and model of the car.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that was the big gotcha moment in the trial where he says, were you standing behind that car when you called it in? He's like, no.
Yeah, it got me. I was like, why in the hell would he call that
How
in
would
if
he know?
Was not looking right at it?
But if you really think about it, and this is a fairly simple explanation, it was still a missing person at this point. There was no murder. There was no, you know, nobody arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And they already knew all that information. And so what had happened was, as they're investigating all this and they're going to places that Teresa had been that day, a detective had called him and told him, this is what we're looking for. This is the car. This is the make and model in the tag. Here's the missing car.
Yeah.
This is the missing person we're looking for. And so he said he takes this call and he's driving. So, and you can kind of picture you're on the phone right here and you're driving like this and you're trying to write down something. And that's what he said he was happening, and he didn't immediately pull over.
That's the BOL thing. To be on the lookout was for the car. And I said it was like a be on the lookout warrant
on that other thing. Yeah.
No, that's what it was. Because I heard that phrase. He was like, it was a BOL, and it was a be on the lookout for that car.
Right.
That guy told him all to look for that.
So
think about that. I'm sorry, reenact that again.
No, that's fine.
Yes.
You know, you're driving.
You're driving.
You the phone.
He's telling you this stuff.
You know, you're writing with this hand. You got the hand on the wheel. I'm trying to get around the mic here. But he's scribbling this down in his lap is what he's basically saying.
Yes.
So then what happens is he goes over to the Zipper residence. Now, the Zippers is the other people that Teresa went to that day to take pictures of Auto Trader magazine. So he pulls in this church parking lot across from the Zipper residence, waiting on these other cops to come because they go speak to these people about Teresa's disappearance. And that's where he calls in dispatch to verify that this is what he wrote down, because he wasn't sure exactly with his scribbling while driving. And then, so for years, nobody knew when this was. They all said it was on the 4th, his day off.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you know, what'd you do on your day off? And he was like, I went and checked on my mother-in-law, which I did every day. I went into town, ran some errands, I think. And then me and my wife, you know, ate dinner and stayed home all night, whatever. No big deal. But he couldn't remember exactly all the details of the mundane cop day at work. You know, it's like, well, you do remember your days off and the good times. You don't remember mundane work days.
Yeah.
Every little detail.
They all bleed together.
They do. So the point being that nobody knew exactly what day this came in, even during the trial.
Nope.
No timestamps on the calls. They got the call logs, but they were just in chronological order. No timestamps and all that good stuff. Well, a guy named Rookie, who you'll see throughout this documentary, who is a truther, who believes Stephen Avery is innocent, and they were all set up, actually got this information years and years later. They got sent from Manitowoc County to him, I guess from some records act or whatever.
14 years later.
14 years. That's a long time.
It is. That's how long it took.
And this is how long it took. You know, people thought that this cop called in on his day off for this big setup, and he knew the car because he's already, you know, had found it or was, you know, planting it or whatever. Well, turns out it was on the 2nd. Was that right?
The third
at 8:20-something p.m., or I believe that's right, somewhere. I know it's 8-something p.m., and that puts him exactly where he said he was in this church parking lot at the Zipper residence, because that is confirmed to be where they talked to. You know, that's on the record.
Right.
This is an indisputable fact. He was at this church, at this residence, because then after that, they go speak to these people at this time.
Yes. Now, another huge thing about that was that he called in on a cell phone.
Yeah, another big
why not the radio?
Why not the radio?
Right.
I mean,
well, he says, look, she's a missing person. We know that people have scanners. What if she's being kidnapped and the person who's holding her has a scanner and they're like, oh, God, they're, you know, this and that.
They don't know the cops know anything at this point.
Right. So he said, and just to keep it quiet in general, I mean, it makes sense to call over the phone to check his scribbling, like he said.
Yep.
And thank goodness that it was logged like that, and they found out after all these years now, because that was such a huge thing that I've brought up to you in conversation, and to anybody that'll listen is like, he saw that damn car. I know he did.
He knew the make and model. He had to be standing behind it. And oops, it slipped up. And the way they edited everything was, you know, he was all nervous on the stand when asking this question.
If you're open-minded, you have to say it's as likely to be what they're saying in this documentary.
Yes.
As
correct.
He's looking at it and calling it in and seeing it before it ever shows up on the salvage yard.
Exactly. 100%. And to top that off, that's just documented fact now, as far as I'm concerned. To top it off, the way they edited the trial footage was really deceiving. So these filmmakers, you know, I don't know if they'll be doing any interviews anytime soon, honestly.
I can't imagine.
Because they took this, when he's specifically, Stephen's lawyer says, were you standing behind that vehicle when you called in? And he says, no, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They took his answer I said, you think that would look suspicious?
Yeah.
And he's like, yes. But the truth is he never answered that question.
He did not.
The Kratz, being the prosecution, objected, and the judge agreed. So he never actually answered that question.
Mm-mm.
The very next question was almost the opposite.
Yeah.
And he answered yes, and they put that into the edit.
Yeah. What he answered yes to was, so when you called this in, this was just like any of the other licenses you've called in over the years,
yeah,
or whatever.
Just like every other one.
Every other one.
Yes.
Yes.
And on top of that, this one little, everybody made a big deal of the body, like you said, the body language people.
Yes.
You know, made a big deal of how he kind of was crossing his hand. He kind of leaned back like he was nervous.
Looked
about
nervous.
This question. Well, turns out that that was just when he was waiting to be questioned. That wasn't even during that question.
No.
That was like when he's just like up there, he's waiting for somebody to approach him or attorney to get up and start asking questions. They used that shot 3 times.
Yeah, now think about that.
3 times.
3 times.
Not just, they didn't let the natural trial play out. I'm obviously not going to cut, leave in just dead space where he's just sitting there. But they used that specific dead space to make him look like he was nervous about being asked that question.
Yeah. So if they showed it 3 times, they knew that yeah. shot made him look a certain way.
Yes.
So they are really trying hard to deceive you by using it over and over again. And to make him look bad, like you said.
Yeah.
Even Netflix, they told him, when you show the cops, play this ominous music.
Yeah, we may not have mentioned that in this. This is take two.
Right.
Yeah, we found that out from other interviews that from Sean Reck, who's the director, mm-hmm. is when Netflix took this, they actually made them, again, they didn't produce it themselves, but they actually made them make it worse as far as like, play more ominous music when you're showing the cops and all this kind of stuff. So they used these, storytelling methods to tell this narrative that they wanted to tell. And then just real quick, when Brendan got involved, they made a phone call to Stephen Avery and said, hey, look, we're still with you all the way.
Yes.
That's a little weird if you're just trying to tell a documentary.
Yep.
Because a documentary is a documentary. It's about truth and facts and both sides, every side.
And after it came out and they were being interviewed by everybody and they're even asked, hey, why did you leave this out or whatever? I didn't like that one of them said, we make documentaries, so we're storytellers.
Right.
Now I'm like, no, if you're a documentarian, you should be a truth teller. That's the way I feel.
Right. And that,
or
that
say
may involve
up front.
Some storytelling, sure. I mean, there's certainly, nobody's denied
but,
to make
but
it
I
more
think,
entertaining.
I feel like the storytelling when you're a documentary maker is more with the way you shoot things.
Yes.
And organize them.
Yes, exactly.
Not
but
like
not cutting
fabricate
out exactly.
things, to make a story.
Not cutting evidence out and certain words and lines that are missing from this whole dialogue and rearranging them. That's not, documentation.
And when you see this, I know we talked about it on the last one, but when you see the split screen and they show this side is what was on Making a Murderer, this is court document that shows what was really said.
Yeah.
You're going to be shocked. I think you should be shocked.
Yeah. I mean, at least at that particular aspect. I mean, they literally show you side by side what was shown in Making a Murderer and then the actual either footage of the trial.
True. Yeah.
The full conversation or the actual
transcript. Yeah.
And how they just skip the whole paragraph or two.
Or make this mosaic of it almost.
Yeah.
Sometimes they'll snip here, put here, and
really,
rearrange
really
things.
So that's not, like you said, a documentarian. That's a storyteller. That's a story. That's a narrative. And again, I know people will say, but they're telling their narrative. Yeah, we're not saying that they're not telling another side, but it is another side. It's kind of different when it's a reaction to
it really
a
is
documentary.
Different.
You can't just say it's their own little narrative. I mean, there's factual stuff here.
Yes.
It's not just, I'm not saying they don't shoot it entertaining and rearrange things or whatever. We're not talking about that, but clearly it's a little different when it's a rebuttal series.
It is, because more or less what they're doing is saying, hey, remember this thing that pissed you off?
Yes.
This is really what happened.
Right.
There's not much of a narrative going on there.
Right. Exactly. So then the other thing, I think in episode six, the another big aspect that was left completely out of Making a Murder was the burn barrel and not yes. barbs, because they mentioned barbs and they did find some bigger bone fragments in there. But Stephen's personal burn barrel, they never brought up whatsoever. So he did have a burn barrel on his property. And I don't think that's a big surprise. We got another cat hole over here trying to tear shit up. But the big thing...
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think it's a big surprise.
No, but... not at all. But when they asked him, have you burned any fires out there? And he says, no, not in about 2 weeks. Okay, no big deal. But then it comes to find out that Earl... his brother Earl and his friend, and I have his name written here that I scribbled out, but it's Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Fabian, I believe it is.
I think you are right.
So they come up that day, this day, the 31st, and they're on a golf cart coming up to Stephen's trailer, and they saw the burn barrel in his yard smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he adds a little detail. It smelled like plastic, but the way they know this is because the smoke was in his face, and he asked Earl to pull the golf cart up a little further.
Right. So that's something that would stick out in your mind.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, sure.
And Stephen basically over and over again said nothing was burnt. He didn't burn anything.
No.
And so you could say, well, they're on the same property. Somebody, whoever's framing him,
right,
could put the stuff in Stephen's burn barrel. But isn't it odd that he's saying nothing burnt in there? Like, everybody knows Stephen's burn barrel burnt, but Stephen? Bullcrap.
Right. And then the thing about the fires in general, remember, there was no bonfire brought up at all until Barb and Stephen's conversation.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, "There, I had no fire." And then, yes, you did that night. What night? The night I went to visit... Scott's mom in the hospital, which was the 31st. We had established that already. I saw the fire.
It's weird. He said, well, Brendan would have been with me.
Yeah, and then Brendan was with me all of a sudden. So then it changed again to, oh, yeah, yeah. I had a bonfire, and then I invited Brendan over.
Mm-hmm.
So we established in the first podcast, you know, his story definitely changed. You know, he told his brother, photographer never showed up. And then it was, oh, yeah, she came, but I just saw her out the window. And then it was... the current version, if you will, of, you know, yeah, she came, took pictures, I walked out, she paid me, she handed me the Auto Trader magazine.
Yeah.
So this is the second big instance of no fires, hadn't burned anything in a couple of weeks. Maybe Jody did before she went, she was in jail that night.
Right.
But then two different people, including I think Brendan's brother also testified he saw the burn barrel as well.
And there, as far as the filmmakers... Again, yes, they mentioned that her camera and stuff, her electronics were found in a burn barrel.
Yes.
But it was always, to me, it felt like they were behind Barb's house.
That's 100% what I thought, because they never mentioned his burn barrel. They just mentioned things we found the burn barrel, including that stuff, but Barb's, that's where everything was, back there, away from his house.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the big next obvious thing is this is where her actual camera, cell phone, and PDA were found. And again, they took those remaining parts, the metallic stuff, all that, matched it up to the boxes and all that, confirmed that was her stuff in his burn barrel that he did not have a fire for that day.
Right.
But actually did. So that's pretty overwhelming evidence right there to lie about just having fires. I mean, you're in an auto salvage yard. I'm sure they burn shit all the time. And it's not a big deal to have a fire out there almost all the time.
It's not.
But to you kind of put yourself in a corner when you told the investigator on the phone, and they played this conversation.
Yeah.
I hadn't. It's been about 2 weeks, and I just burned garbage. You know, I'm sure he does burn trash out there.
Yeah.
But he definitely had a fire that day.
Yeah, why? That's another thing against him. And you know, I am one of the people who I really believed that he – at least should get a new trial.
Yeah, at the very minimum, he did not. It did not happen the way they presented it. New trial, and let's go over all this stuff. You know, Brendan, obviously, he's false confession, all that kind of stuff as well.
But the fact that He was directly asked multiple times, did you burn anything? And he says no. Okay, what would he lie for? Again, you know these people burn their trash.
Mm-hmm.
So he could have said, yeah, some trash or something, you know.
Yeah.
Said
I do it all the time.
Why? Yeah, why? He knew him and Brendan had a bonfire. That is clear. The things Brendan named, we went around and got some tires and a couch or something. Yep. And you can clearly see, yes, okay, there's some rims. There's some springs from a couch, an old friend, you know what I mean? So
the steel belting from the tires.
Yeah, it's clear that happened. Why, if you're Steven, why would you deny or lie? Why would you just straight up say, yeah, we had a bonfire on Halloween after she took the pictures and left.
Yeah.
We cleared up some stuff and burned it. Why did he wait till after to start going, oh, yeah, we rounded up some stuff and burned it?
Because, like I said, I mean, this is a property where everybody lives. Everybody can see each other out windows if they look or they come out. They go to each other's houses all the time and just walk in. They're family, for Christ's sake. I mean, it shouldn't have been a big deal, but the fire never even came up until Brendan came into the picture about any fires, much less the burn barrel that was just completely left out of making a murder. So they would have you believe that, you know, again, the way they presented it is these items were found in Barb's burn barrel behind her house near the fire pit where supposedly she was burned. All right, so next we had in this episode was the big, you know, another aha moment, the key. The infamous key that just magically appeared.
Yes. So that was a huge thing in the documentary.
Very big. Very big. So, you know, the key was, the place was searched seven times and never found anything. Then all of a sudden, magically, a key appears in the seventh search. First off, I think we mentioned in the last podcast, it was technically only two searches. The rest of the five were what they call targeted searches. So that's where, hey, go in and get the gun. Go in and get this or that or the porn stash.
Yes.
So not like we're picturing where they go in and flip everything over and search detailed.
Right.
And somehow miss that key. So the key is a big thing. Obviously, you know, it's her key. It fits her car. It's got his blood on it, his DNA, but not hers, which is still very odd to me.
Yeah.
And I think
me too.
You agree.
Mm-hmm.
And what they didn't show in Making a Murder is exactly how these searches took place and how it magically, at least a possibility on how this key just kind of fell out of this bookshelf magically, was there's a back that was actually kind of peeled open. So if you picture, you know, everybody's put together some piece of furniture, little bookshelf, whatever, you turn it around and you tack on the back little pieces, whether it's a wood panel or cardboard, this looked to be wood, that was actually loose.
Yeah.
All the way down.
Conveniently, on Making a Murderer, they show angles of this thing where they don't show the bottom where the back is open about an inch. They might show that side, but they never show the bottom of it.
Right. They never kind of pan down to the whole thing.
And, I mean, you can clearly see these are photographs taken as evidence that they could have easily put on the screen the full picture where they're showing, hey, this thing's open at the bottom. So if a key was in the back, and actually the way, what's his name?
Colburn
yep. described it is, look, I was tired of dealing with Steven's porn. So they sent us out there to get some porn, and we're searching, where would porn be? Oh, here's some papers and some notebooks and stuff down here.
Right.
He opens up this three-ring binder, looks, nothing in there, slams it. He's like, I'm kind of aggravated, so I admit I do slam it. He said, I'm not saying I knocked the back out on it.
Right.
But I did slam it in there pretty hard. The back was open, so let's say there was a key at the very back.
Right.
Maybe, like Chris has said before, it could have been kind of pinched in there from maybe previous searches or whatever, but somehow when they pushed it, now that you know that there's an inch wide opening on the back,
yes,
it's easy to go, a key could fall out of that thing.
Yes, it at least gives the possibility where before it was just like a magical thing where it fell out from behind the wall.
Yeah.
You know, there was no holes in the wall.
No secrets. They made it seem magical,
yeah. They really did. And so now at least, you know, again, there's no clear-cut answer for the key.
No, there's not.
Because they even said to them, you know, on this documentary, you know, Elaine never said, hey, there's a key on the floor, and everybody was surprised to see it because they had just searched that and it wasn't there. But now if you know that there's this opening and they're shoving things back in there, you know, he said pretty forcefully,
yeah,
then you know there's at least a possibility that there was a key in there that fell out.
Right.
And they had moved it and tilted it, and people were talking about the quarters on top. Well, they should have been gone or moved, and they were different. So you don't, you know, but the way they described it is, you know, I think Colburn, you know, he kind of tilted it out and turned it and whatever. But I don't remember him saying he like shook it hard or anything like that. That wouldn't make any sense. But it's moving it around, you know, for sure.
And even Kratz said he was puzzled by it, by the change being on the top and not disturbed. He's like, hey, I don't know how that makes sense either.
Right.
But I didn't need the key.
It pissed him off
that he found it, that they found
because
it.
Because of the Manitowoc County officers, which is, that was the public perception, which is why they made you think in making a murder they wouldn't allow it out there, when in fact that was Manitowoc County DA. That was his decision, is to have somebody with them just to cover their asses. Yeah. But they were allowed.
Yeah, they were allowed. They had said they were going to try to recuse themselves or whatever.
Yeah,
but
correct.
Unfortunately, the other county I just named earlier,
Calumet
County, just didn't have the resources.
No, these are very small towns.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they gave the impression in Making a Murder, this, I said this last podcast, that you kept showing the kind of the nice courthouse and all that. And you're like, you know, this, for some reason you pictured this big sheriff's department.
Right.
And you're probably talking about, what, 15 traffic cops or something at the most?
Right. And
I mean, they literally called in the state patrol, state troopers for security around the place. They called in firemen and people just to search cars. It was such a big, you know, you got 40 acres. That's giant as for a crime scene.
And if those guys found any evidence, they weren't trained on how to handle it as well.
Right.
So they had to have these officers from Manitowoc County
who were trained evidence gatherers. And that's why they sent them in there specifically. So if you're going to frame this guy from a county that he's suing at the moment, there's a lawsuit going on from his previous conviction, where he was, you know, legitimately convicted of something he did not commit. Why send those guys?
Right.
Why send them in there if you're going to plant a key?
That's just
have one of your own go in there and find a key.
Yeah, that would be that's really dumb.
It really is. I mean, so if you think about it, just if you take a step back from this whole thing and the emotion of it, and you remove the key, if you can imagine that didn't even exist in Making a Murderer, you don't need the key. You really don't. And I mean, look, I'm agreeing with Kratz. I never thought I'd say that, but you do not need this key. You have a car on his property with his blood in it and her blood in it.
So
why do you
what?
Need a key?
Yeah. Now, I did say something about they were trained evidence handlers and everything. I still have problems with the way they handled some of the evidence.
Yes.
As they do. And
yes.
They admit, if we had to do it over again, definitely would have done a better job at some of these things.
Differently,
yeah.
I think. Yep.
So don't think I'm just, you know, totally, oh, they said they had, you know, they were trained evidence handlers. You know, I'm not saying they didn't make mistakes. They absolutely did.
Yeah, and I think it was still a strong point. The last podcast we mentioned, you know, if they were going to plant something, they never knew they were going back in there. Why not do it the first time
that
they went in there?
I mean, really?
I mean, they didn't know they were going back. They didn't, you know, he sent other teams in there between those visits. So, you know, plant it and then let the other team find it.
That's what I would do. Yeah, me too.
Makes sense to me. But the key is obviously a big thing. And again, there's still going to be arguments about the key. It's never going to be clear because they admit themselves it's very odd on how it was, you know, they looked at this thing and then there was no key. And then all of a sudden there was a key when they turned around and two different, you know, three people missed it. Until he happened to look down and there it is. So again, no clear cut thing, and this whole case will never be clear cut. We'll never know exactly what happened in this case. I think the next little part of this episode to wrap up this episode was basically the blood evidence. You know, the car, the you know, they had to plant the blood because he's got a cut on his right hand. They showed that cut many, many times, and you know, but it was healing up, so it couldn't have been dripping all over the place. And you agree when you see, especially season two, Kathleen Zellner test all this stuff.
Yeah,
you can't crank the car with that right hand and get blood in that little recessed area.
Can't happen.
Can't happen. Physics is physics. I said before we started watching it, don't matter what they say, physics is physics.
Yeah.
But they didn't show us how the car was parked.
And that really, when I saw that picture,
I know,
that pissed me off.
I know. Because you're still... It's like a foot
between that car and the car beside it on the driver's side.
On the driver's side. So Kratz actually brings up in the discussion with Rookie, the truther who's in, you know, throughout this documentary. And he says, this is what the experts say. He reached in from the passenger side, and he's got this little cut, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he reaches over to get the keys because he, whatever reason, he, and why do you need the key? Why are you going to take it out of your house?
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, he wants the key, so he reaches back in, drip across the passenger seat, another drip right there, the passenger seat as well. I think a third is kind of in the console, on the edge of the console.
Yeah, the one on the door frame, the passenger door jamb, that one always perplexed me.
Yeah.
Why, if Steven's driving it,
is there any on the door jamb? On the passenger side.
That really explains it.
It explains the path all the way to the key ignition, where you would put the key in. So if you're reaching in across, reaching in, bending over,
mm-hmm.
drip, 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 key, pulled it out. Then you got the little door jamb on the back door on that side, and then her CD case.
We can only assume that Steven would probably do it at night. I mean, I don't think he's driving that RAV4 around there during the day.
No, he's got family there.
Yes, and they're looking for that car, you know. So I said they're looking for the car. I don't know when the car was parked there. So it might have been parked there before anybody knew they should have been looking, but they all knew she was missing at that point, right?
Yeah, I would imagine the car was parked there that night.
The next day, I would say people would have been looking for it. So let's say it was parked there that night. So his family wouldn't have been looking for it. But I'm just saying, I don't think he would have drove it in the daytime. So now, picture that. He's probably, he had to crawl out the passenger side. If he got out the driver's side when he got out, he squeezed and squeezed to get out of there.
Yeah, he
when
sucked you see his how gut close in there, and squeezed. I mean, so hard.
So he's probably walking away and goes, damn, let me get the key. And he reaches in. But that explains, because his right hand is cut on his middle finger.
Yeah.
As Zellner tried to show when he's trying to crank it, that's what Kratz is like. No, he's not cranked. Don't think about the cranking. He reaches back in, grabs it. You could easily see how he could get in that recessed spot.
Yeah, from that position, that angle from the passenger side, and it shows almost a path to the blood.
It does.
To the key, or to the ignition. Yeah.
And another big, huge thing, he had a Grand Am.
This is huge, man.
That he drove personally.
A blue Grand Am.
Yeah.
Never saw this in Making a Murder.
Never. And it was in the trial, brought up in a trial. And he admitted to bleeding in it. And guess what? The blood looks eerily similar, because I've heard so many people say, well, nobody would bleed a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there, 6 inches here. And if he's actively bleeding, it would be all over the place. No, his car looked really similar to her car.
I mean, they didn't even mention his car in Making a Murder. They didn't show his car. Mm-mm. They didn't say that it was impounded by the police with blood in it. And he admitted he bled in his car.
That's right.
And I think I think what's confusing is the term active bleeder.
Yeah.
An active bleeder, you're thinking of like drip, 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 or whatever.
Right.
But everybody's had that cut that you smack and it gets busted back open or whatever, and it's like a drip. And then you don't even know it sometimes. And then in another drip, you look back on the floor and you see like a drip 3 feet apart.
That's right.
Something like that.
Something you always notice
later. It's not
later.
Like a squirt. It's not like a bad cut where it's pouring.
Yep.
So I think that word confuses people when they say, you know, the experts say active bleeder.
I do too.
That's all that means. It doesn't mean the rate of blood or anything like that. So it just, when you sit back and think about it, you see the picture of how close that was. It makes sense. And then again, not even to get into the blood vial, because we all know that everybody is aware that that EDTA was not found. It was not from that blood vial. Everybody's going and got blood drawn. You see how they get the hole in the top. The nurse explained that. So that's not, and the defense dropped all that, by the way. They never told us that in making a murder.
Right.
The blood vial, they brought it up, and then they're like, yeah, the nurse testified, and that was it. They dropped it. They never mentioned it again. So then this went to, well, they must have got the blood out of the sink or something.
Mm-hmm.
But just a little side note, just to get the before somebody mentions the blood vial, because that's still, that's been completely debunked by Kathleen Zellner herself. This is not like some conspiracy thing. So the point being is, you know, if I'm going to plant blood, I've watched some shows, I've watched some, you know, true crime stuff, whatever it may be, I'm going to put it in obvious places on the steering wheel, the gear shift, all that
rear
kind of
view
stuff.
Mirror.
Rear view mirror. Kind of like it was in his car, very near the gear shift. But they didn't show you that in Making a Murder. They didn't even show his car. And certainly didn't about the part where he bled in and admitted it. So it's very odd. That, you know, again, it's just on our parts, guesstimations and just, you know, a little back and forth about possibilities. We will never know, but it's certainly more possible than, you know, just as likely as somebody going and getting some kind of, you know, vial of liquid blood and putting drips different ways and swabs over here and doing it all different ways.
Right now, I am speaking to people who have watched Making a Murderer, but have yet to, for one reason or another, watch Convicting a Murderer.
Yeah.
But are listening to us talk about it. Okay? I'm speaking to you.
Uh-oh.
I was just like you.
100%.
I was duped. I really hated the cops, believed Stephen was wrongfully imprisoned, wrongfully convicted, or at least the jury
was tainted. The jury pool.
Totally. Yep.
Yeah.
Because 100%. Of that interview. I mean, the press conference.
Yep. Crap.
It was either a tainted jury pool or they were just idiots or the wrong evidence got. I don't know, but I totally believed everything in Making a Murderer. It was yelling at the TV sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, I can't believe you mother effers were doing that.
Are you fucking kidding me? You know, it is just ridiculous.
And I bought how pitiful his mom was, his dad was.
Yeah.
You know, they were. And there are some things in this that surprise me about both of them.
Sure.
Not saying they're bad people or anything. Just surprising is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
But I'm speaking to you people who are like, my mind's made up. There's a frame job, whether the cops framed him or the real killer framed him, whatever. Watch this. Please watch this thing. It will blow your mind.
Yeah. And don't watch it with that attitude like we almost had. Like, there's nothing you can say that's going to change my mind.
Right.
Just watch it. Open-minded. I'm telling you.
Yes.
There's so much stuff.
I don't know if you said this on take one or you said it earlier in this take, but can't wait to see what Kathleen Zellner says.
Please, please address it because, you know, she did all the testing and all that stuff. And, you know, we still believe the splatter all of a sudden on the back of the hatch and all that stuff. It did not get there by throwing somebody into the car. It was probably slung off something.
Yes.
So we definitely still believe that it happened differently the way they presented it. We're not saying it's exactly like that because stuff still don't make sense with that. But it's just showcasing what they cut out of this thing and made him and cut out a lot of phone conversations with his parents for that matter. He literally says to his dad something about the gun and, you know, he's a felon. And the gun did belong to the trailer owner,
right?
Which we didn't know about either.
Right.
And he said, I wiped it off. And then his dad said, huh? Or something like that. And he's like, I'm on TV. I'm on TV, and just kind of immediately change the subject.
Yes.
Like, why would you say you wiped it off?
And it's not the only time on there they show that he says something and almost realizes he said it and like, and oh, then, yeah, these calls are recorded. I forgot for a second.
Exactly. There's a few of those moments.
Yeah, he's talking about the 22, and he's telling on another call, he says, well, it's just a 22. I mean, it's not going to kill somebody. I mean, you could kill somebody. I mean, something with it.
Right.
But it's a 22.
It ain't going to do nothing.
Yeah, it ain't going to do nothing. But he catches himself twice on there.
Right. And there's things, God, I can't mention. Obviously, we can't spoil anything past episode 7. But
I know.
I can't wait to be able to talk about that as well. But anyway, and, you know, then he went to really quick, the blood from the sink, and that's damn near impossible. He believes that, you know, well, they got in my trailer and I bled that night because I busted that cut open. It was in the sink, but I didn't clean it up. Then I went to the store. So somebody was waiting right by your house to go in there and grab blood while still liquid or not, you know, coagulated everywhere.
Right.
Scooped it all up into something and then ran to the car, which had to be very close by, and did the drips and did the rubbing and all that stuff, and then locked it and took the key. And
yeah.
It's really, when you start thinking that way logically, it's really hard to believe that you have to have a source of that blood. And again, that whole blood vial was ruled out way early. Even the defense ruled that out.
And so, honestly,
I mean, it's just kind of sense.
If it's Stephen Avery's dirty sink where this blood was supposed to be,
yeah,
don't you think that Jody's DNA may show up in that blood sample from brushing her teeth in that sink? And there's no telling what
something.
I don't know.
Particles of toothpaste?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it was.
I mean, why?
Stephen Avery is not a guy who's cleaning up every day, but he's got carpet cleaners and vacuums and shit. Now, again, you did mention, you know, Jody was going to be getting out or something. I don't remember when exactly, but she was still in jail that night. But she had been there. She had, stayed with him. So maybe, you know, she was cleaning or whatever, and they had conversation about the rug doctor having problems with it. I might take it back. And then they found, you know, there was a brand new one there. They didn't find anything inside the rug doctor. A lot of little things like that. It's like Stephen Avery's not a guy that cleans up a lot.
Right.
He may throw some junk every once in a while in a fire and burn it up or burn trash, but his you know, you can't look at that house and think he's like a clean dude.
Mm.
Like he's a neat freak. I mean, come on.
I mean, the logistics of all these things, man, like he said, somebody would have to say, oh, it looks like he's going to Menards. He's about to leave the house to go to Menards. He leaves. Run in there really fast, because how much time would you have to get fresh blood out of a sink? Now, I do know that Kathleen Zellner is entertaining the sink theory, because she went and took the sink out.
Yeah.
So maybe she has blood experts.
I think she has Bobby going in there, you know, Bobby
and,
Dassey.
Yeah. And so, but to me, like you said, they'd have to be hiding outside. They leave.
They'd have to know he was bleeding.
There. Yeah. What are you looking for in there? You have to know. Go straight to the blood in the bathroom.
Think that he's keeping a vial of his own blood in the fridge or something?
I don't get it.
And again, that goes back to the EDTA stuff. It has to be in something that keeps blood from coagulating. It's weird.
Did they go in there looking for anything, see the blood, and go, oh, this would be great? Now they got to get, how do they get the blood, scrape it up out of there?
Right.
Out of the sink.
Did they come prepared with gloves and some kind of special
weird
container to suck it up in? And I don't know. It's very odd when you start really thinking about it.
Do they get Stephen hammered? He passes out and they're over there milking his finger down.
Right. Exactly. I mean, that would be more logical than a sink.
I agree.
Like, a really slip him a roofie and then just, you can get blood, but you have to have an active source.
Yeah.
And that's the problem with the theories, is that once that blood vial is ruled out, because, you know, clearly it was opened by his previous lawyers and the nurse talked about the hole, because that's how they get the blood in it, not out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, once that's ruled out, you got to have blood.
You got to.
And
it's got to be liquid enough.
Liquid.
To where it can't be watered down, dried up blood that you've shook up in something and dripped everywhere, because that's going to look like watered down blood.
Yeah.
These blood experts, they know what they're looking at.
Yeah. And that's they did do that. They made like the state's people look like idiots, and then Kathleen Zellner's were experts, you know, like the real experts or something. And once you go back through it, it's like, no, and you think about it that way, what they're saying makes sense. It's not that hard as far as like, you know, you just need blood. You got to have blood to get blood in a car.
Yeah.
And his own car had the same shit in it in the same way. And they never mentioned that.
And I look at Stephen as, you know, this sad figure who's lost 18 years of his life, just like everybody else, man. But I cannot come up with any logical explanation of why he is not the killer because of that blood.
Right.
I'm telling you, I think I can explain away in my mind, or, you know, can at least argue all the other things, but that, because let's say he did not kill her, but he knows who did, and he's helping them get rid of the car. Right. That's just as bad.
Yeah, it is.
So, I mean, he's 100% where he
belongs. Exactly, 100%.
But he bled in that car.
He did. There's no ifs, ands, buts about it anymore. No. Like I said, once the blood vial's gone, which is a clear, easy source of blood, which you can drip and dab it and have whatever you want. Once that's gone out of the picture, which again the defense dropped in the trial, they just didn't pursue it anymore. You don't have anything left.
Because I'm telling you right now, if they drew blood from him in jail, in prison, first off, Stephen Avery's not going to let anybody draw blood, don't have a warrant.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it would be documented. He would be able to clearly say they drew blood from me on this day, this day, this day, and they might have went out there and done that.
And all he said was they did the first time, which, again, that's the vial.
But that's got the EDTA in it.
Yeah, that's the vial.
So it's got to be this time when he was locked up for having the firearm by a felon.
Right.
They would have had to have taken blood then.
So in those three days, I think it was.
Yeah, right? So think about that.
For the firearm, 3 or 4 or 5 days later, he was charged with murder.
He bled in there.
He
bled in that car. I'm sorry. And I know it breaks a lot of people's hearts. It broke my own.
Yeah, really. I mean, again, maybe not exactly. It didn't happen the way they presented exactly, but he had to have. And real quick, before we get out of here, we've got to talk about Brendan in episode 7. So episode 7 really focuses on Brendan.
Because
this is always the big caveat, right? Stephen may have done it, but Brendan, he is. And then again, I do have empathy for the kid.
Yeah.
He's a poor kid. He got roped into this, and he's covering for his uncle. And I believe that to some degree. But they didn't also play all of that. Now, let me just say up front, the confession part where he's, you know, clearly guessing about
no doubt
a cutter, and they're like, cut what? Her hair? And they're like, hair?
Yeah. What happened to her head? He punched her.
He punched. I mean, clearly. And then, of course, the federal courts agreed, habeas corpus, and then that was upheld and then overturned in the Supreme. But as far as being involved, he knew some things. He actually put this on himself, come to find out. So the first time they spoke to him was in a car when he was riding with his brother, not Bobby, but the other brother, I believe. And, you know, they're asking him questions, and he says, I believe, something to the effect of, they're asking about Therese. Did you see her taking a picture? I can't remember, all that kind of stuff. And then he says, you think he did it?
Well,
again,
my note here says November 6th was their first interview with Brendan.
Yeah.
He mentions rape.
He says, you think he did it? And the cop says, think he did what? You think you raped her?
That's a week, not even a week after the damn thing.
Nobody had mentioned nobody knew about any raping or anything at that point. So, you know, he said it. It's on tape. You can hear him say it.
So here's my thing about Brendan that everybody knows that's watched it. He's all over the place.
He really is.
I mean, it's pitiful. I still have trouble with Brendan, and Chris will tell you. I will say a lot of this docuseries puts a lot of weight on Brendan, and I think the reason they do is because we all know that Steven wouldn't be where he's at or wouldn't have been then without Brendan.
Yeah. They needed
without that confession.
They needed that for sure.
Yeah.
And that gives, you know, credence to the whole, we got to find somebody to, to set up here. Of course.
And I feel like he got a bum rap and everything, but he, okay. So Teresa goes missing on Halloween. Brendan and Steven have a bonfire. I don't think anybody would argue those on either side.
Yeah.
She goes missing the same day they had a bonfire. Okay. On the 6th, they interview him. He mentions the word rape.
Do you think he did it? What do you mean he did what? Do you think he raped her? Yep.
We and Chris were like, how did they not dig into that deeper on November the 6th? He just said that. Well, guess what? On February the 20th, they talked to his cousin, Kayla. I think that's her name, right?
Kayla, correct.
Okay. Yep. She says, you might want to talk to my cousin, Brendan. He's lost a lot of weight. He's crying all the time. He's staring off into space.
And just to throw this in there, the specific question I think that made her say that was, has Steven ever touched you in any odd ways that you're uncomfortable with or something to that effect? And then I believe she said, you need to talk to my cousin, Brendan.
Ooh.
Because he mentioned that to Barb, I think, at one point.
So. Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
Definitely. So, now, we said on 11-6, they interview him the first time. 2-20, they interview Kayla. She says, look at my cousin, Brendan. A week later, on the 27th of February, they have their second interview with him at school.
At school.
He says he saw a body. It's the first time he says that. They're like, wait a minute. We need to get him to a better spot. So they, on that same day, call Barb, get her to come down there. They go over to this place called Two Rivers.
A small police department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so after that, he says enough to where they're like, okay, we need to talk more. We're going to put you up in this resort. They kind of want to keep them away from, they know he's implicating Steven, and they don't know what's up, so that he could be in danger, or maybe they just want to keep him away from influence of family members, whatever the case may be. So 4 days later, on March 1st, is that infamous interview where he's sitting there and he confesses. Now, to me, that's sloppy on the police's part. I just, I don't like that. I don't like that at all. Because you said the losing weight doesn't mean a thing.
Mm-mm. You're talking about, they made it like you, it's not normal for a kid to lose weight. Well, you're talking about 4 months, not 2 weeks.
Right.
He could have lost weight because he's trying.
Mm-hmm.
He could have been turned down by a girl or bullied at school.
Yeah. Somebody called him fatty. You never know.
Depression can come in many forms for a young kid, especially one like him with a low IQ, all that stuff, I'm assuming.
Right.
And that you can't just say, we went over there to check on him. Cops don't go check on kids because they're losing weight.
No.
But they went because they think he knows something. And that's what I mean in the interview at school, in which is what made him, when that's the first time he admitted knowing anything, like I saw things.
Yeah.
Then they go record him at the police station to get it on camera, even though they had the audio before, but they wanted it on camera. He basically gave him the same information, but when they directly asked him, right, at that time, did you have anything to do with her dead parents? No. Did you do anything to her? No. It was all no's. And that was pretty much, okay, he's a witness now. He's saying, you know, he saw these things at Steven's house.
Now,
here's
the devil's advocate part. I still feel like they were feeding him stuff, even on the 27th. Because remember, I looked at you.
Yeah.
On the 27th, Wiegert said, did you stab her?
Yes. That's.
And I'm like, man, that's leading this guy.
It really, to me, it is.
And
because where did they get an idea that she was stabbed at that point?
Exactly. They had a little piece of her skull with a bullet hole in it. Like, what are they? You know, Steven ain't saying anything about somebody stabbing.
No, he's,
you know,
he's in jail already.
Where do they come up with this? They're feeding that. And then on the first, they get him to confess to stabbing her and asking him how deep and all that. That was the first time, too.
About that much.
Yeah. Yeah. Cut her throat about that deep. Stabbed her in the stomach about that deep. Mm-hmm. Steven did. I don't know, man. I still have a hard time with Brendan.
I do too, and like I said, at this point, and again, until we see, you know, the finale and any more information or whatever, you know, I feel like at this point, with what we've seen through episodes 9, which we can't spoil because there's some things here that they did not put in Making a Murder that it clearly knows something.
Is this further than we can talk about?
Yes, okay, that's why I can't. I want to say it right now.
All right.
But at this point, again, you just mentioned all the confessions. I still do not believe that the actual confession was real. I don't believe it at all. He was clearly led. He was guessing. You can tell the parts where he's recalling and the parts where he's getting. And you don't have to. I mean, look, I'm not an expert. But I don't think you have to be an expert to see that.
No.
But here at this point with Brendan, because like you said, the confession was after it kind of just escalated from nothing, but he did implicate himself. And I did question that too, like you said, if the cops, the other investigator from Calumet County, heard him say, "Do you think he raped her?" I'm not sure why that wasn't immediately.
Yeah.
Why they wasn't on him then?
It's so
months and
wild.
Months later that they go back to him.
Yeah.
But they needed somebody to have corroborated. But I guess that's what made them think, okay, he's the guy out of all these people we're interviewing in the family that's covering for somebody.
Yeah.
I believe.
Now, Chris and I both, I think it was you that really perked up on this. Brendan says something that it just really threw me. Oh, no, it wasn't Brendan. It was a guy recalling Brendan saying this.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so you tell me, correct me if I'm wrong in the comments, but the way I understand it is Teresa was at Steven's place taking the pictures, and supposedly her car was there. Like, she was there. Her car was there at least when Brendan got home from school on the bus.
Yeah. This was during, you know, his interview.
So she was already there, supposedly, right? She must have been in the bedroom, Steven and her, hanky-panky and whatever, right. In the bedroom when Brendan's bus pulls up. This cop, a detective, or somebody is saying Brendan first denied that she was he saw her there.
Right.
And then he says, "Oh, yeah, I did see her. Matter of fact, me and my brother had to move out of the way. So she could pass us."
Yep.
That's weird to me because it definitely wasn't when she was coming.
No.
If that happened.
Because that was too late. That was too late by the booking, the appointments, you know, and the voicemail and all that stuff is like 2:30.
If they had to move out of the way, him and his brother, for her to get by, she would have been leaving.
Yep. But that's the only time that's said, to my knowledge.
Yeah.
It's the only time that's said, to my knowledge.
And if he said it, like I said, it was that guy saying he said that.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I didn't hear that.
But
wait a minute, did they play? They may have played that.
If they did.
I believe they played that audio. Yeah, I believe they did, actually.
And you know, the way we've talked about how his story is all over the place, why does that not matter? But all the other stuff does. You know, some don't, some does, you know, some do. And I don't know. That was odd. I'll entertain it more.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was tonight.
I believe they did play that audio, though, of him saying, "Yeah, me and my brother had to step out of the way for her to pass," because I remember the words.
Pass. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I believe they did play the audio. But that was very odd. And it just he, like you said, he's all over the place. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, he has this confession. Then he says, no, they got my head. And then he tells his mom again that he did it on the phone after they threatened to call her mom. Like, he's still getting in trouble with his mom. And then, you know, he changed it again to I made it up. I got it all out of a book.
Yeah.
So with the Brendan situation at this point, this is where I'm at. I think that the confession in the school, in the police station, Two Rivers, was about as close to the truth as we're ever going to know. Where he did go over there and saw something. Maybe he saw her in the fire, because he said he saw it changed from toes to belly to forehead, and he had these weird reasons why he thought it was those parts.
Yeah, I thought so, too.
It felt morbid talking about it like that, but that's the way he's wording it. But then, you know, they asked him all those direct questions. Were you involved? Did you do this? No. Straight no's. 3 or 4 days later, they got the confession. I think that, and we'll have more evidence to substantiate this when we can talk about it, I think that that's probably closer to the truth right now is where I'm at. That he saw something. At the most, he's some kind of accomplice to maybe hiding the car because he knew details about that, or maybe throwing some stuff on the fire. I don't believe he was in that trailer.
I'll say this.
Or at least did anything in that trailer to her. I don't think he physically could.
I don't either.
The way he described it.
What I believe is they interviewed him on the 6th of November.
Yep.
And what happens? He goes home. They interview him on the 27th. He says he saw a body.
And this was February.
Yes, yep. February 27th. He saw a body. Now, what happens? They call his mom and say, hey, we're going to go talk down here at this other place. So he goes down there, tells them some more really damning things, but bad enough, you know, they're like, we don't want to talk to him again, but we don't want him to go home. But they put him in this, him and his mom in this resort. So in Brendan's mind, he has said some things that are pretty bad. The cops not only let him go home, they put him and his mom in a resort. I told Chris, I said, I think he believes they're kind of his friends.
Oh, yeah.
On his side, he can say anything at this point.
Yep.
And he's going to get to go home and
he's
going to
go get
wrestling.
To watch wrestling.
Yeah.
I need to go back to class. I got a report due in 6th period. You know, all those type of things.
And they're hammering him.
They're 100% using that tactic. I mean,
yeah.
They are. You're doing the right thing. It's okay to say those words here, those type of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
And I just, I feel like he told them what he thought they wanted to hear. That's why he was guessing.
Yep.
That's why he was guessing.
There's nothing I've seen so far in convicting a murderer that leads me to believe that his confession is in any way real as far as the grisly details of guessing about what he's cutting and hitting, punching, and all that kind of stuff. It doesn't make sense. But I do believe, again, now, based off the other things that we'll get to eventually,
mm-hmm.
that there was he saw something. He was involved in a smaller way, and he was covering for Steven. Because it's hard to say that this guy, you know, I saw other videos too. I saw a video on the way home the other night, Candace Owens and Matt Walsh talking about it, and they're so hardcore that he's just an evil little young Michael Myers. That's the other extreme. You can't have sympathy for an evil. No, look, you can have sympathy for somebody that's done something bad.
Yeah,
I don't buy the extreme on either side of that argument. So that's just where I'm at right now as far as Brendan goes. That, you know, based off the stuff that we didn't hear making a murderer, that he knew something, but he didn't. I don't think he participated. I don't think he was physically able to in that situation.
I don't think so either.
We'll get to the grisly details there. You kind of know what we're talking
about.
But
everybody put yourself in his shoes.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
He's a virgin, and supposedly just by his uncle egging him on.
Watching.
Yeah, he's watching.
Yeah.
Telling him what to do. While this lady, we can only assume, like Ken Kratz said in that press conference, is probably you know, crying for her life.
Yeah, and that you can't have that. It was two stories there.
I don't think he could do that.
I don't either. So that's Brendan's always the hard part because you feel more sorry for him than you do Stephen Avery because he's such a young kid and you know, low IQ, the whole thing. So it's tough, man. And I think like everything in that we hear about on the news, or whether it's a true crime story or not, the truth lies somewhere in the middle, and that's kind of where I'm leaning with what we're seeing here.
Yeah.
I mean, look, believe me, I still think that the press conference was bullshit that Ken Kratz did, the way he did it. He says it himself. It was a mistake. He should have just given out press things. But you tainted the jury pool. He was never getting a fair trial. There's no way. But his defense wanted to keep him there because they knew about his other story, so that was supposed to be helping them. So they were bad on his defense too. But I still call bullshit on that, and he's never going to get a fair trial.
Do you think that's a slick lawyer thing to do the press conference saying, well, I'll say it was a mistake later?
Yeah, 100%.
I do too.
Yeah. I don't think he's a great person now all of a sudden. I don't. I think Ken Kratz is still a cocksucker. I mean, to put it bluntly, he says it himself about in some interviews I've seen, not this documentary. But look, I was an arrogant bastard back then. I was on pills, and he did, you know, of course, he had the sexting scandal and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So he actually admits some of that, too.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last thing I'll mention real quick, the bullet. You know, the bullet was found, and Sherry, I think Colhane, was the girl who was the forensic who tested the bullet with her DNA. They found the 122 round. They did edit some testimony there about how he said he found a bullet versus a fragment.
Yeah.
But she did admit to contaminating the control of that. So she had to wash the bullet off. There wasn't enough. And you made a great point. How does she know that? Well, I mean, I guess a microscope, but we don't know. But she washed off all that to a vial to get more as much as possible. Mm-hmm. It was her DNA, Teresa's, but then in the control, she accidentally contaminate it with her own DNA because she said she was teaching some students and she was sitting at this table, this workbench, and probably a little spittle got into the test tube. But they did make it clear that she admitted it. She didn't have to admit that. They didn't have to. They could have said, yep, it's Teresa's blood.
They brought up a good point, too, that she's actually the one that got Stephen Avery out of prison. She's
the same one.
Yeah.
She's the same one that actually tested got him exonerated, tested the thing, and in Alan's hair.
Yeah. So
she's not, like, you know, unbiased or something.
Right. And you know, I question the whole deal of washing the bullet. I do because I know in season two of Making a Murderer, Kathleen Zellner gets that bullet, and that's where she's able to see the pink coloration on the bullet.
Right.
And she throws out that it could be chapstick or whatever, and that's how they got the DNA on there. So, you know, I don't feel like that if that lady looked at it under a microscope, she could have come to the conclusion that there's not enough on
there
to be tested multiple times. So I'm going to get off all I can.
Right.
It's just convenient. And that's what I told Chris. I said there's a lot of the convenient things that happen on the side of the prosecution that you just have to kind of deal with.
Yeah, there is. There certainly is. And in a couple of other videos I was watching, there's mentioning, you know, every single case has these little mistakes. They call them paper mistakes or something to that effect. There's always little things that cops do that could have been done better, and they were, you know, not procedural, or they made a mistake. And that's fine. And you can criticize that, and you should. They should
That's why you have a judge and jury.
That's exactly right. But it doesn't take away from other things. It doesn't mean the other stuff's all wrong. Because she accidentally spit in the control vial does not mean that that was not Teresa's DNA. It just doesn't. Now, again, you can question the method. Hey, by the way, if somebody's a forensic anthropologist and you know how that works, let us know. And, you know, I mean, because we don't know what that means, whether there has to be enough to test, but how does she know that? How does she come to that conclusion to wash it off? Because it can never be tested again.
No.
And that ends up being a crucial part of this murder weapon where her blood or DNA, they say DNA, was on it, and you're assuming blood, right? Because they supposedly cleaned up the garage, but we'll see. But it's really just a crazy, crazy case, roller coaster ride. And again, just... Go ahead.
I was just saying, if this what we've said now doesn't make you scratch your head, just keep watching.
I know.
Because we've seen past what you've seen.
Stay tuned.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, it's absolutely insane. It's kind of a emotional roller coaster too, because it brings you back. And you know, again, I feel for her family. This is coming out, coming back up again. Everybody's, you know, all the armchair quarterbacks are back at it, and the keyboard warriors, and people like us talking about it on podcasts, and you're reliving all that stuff. But I mean, people need to see the other side of this. I think it's important. So I don't give a shit who put the documentary out, Daily Wire, Netflix. It doesn't matter. If you're interested in this case, just watch the damn thing.
Yes.
I mean, if you want the full story, you know, because most of us are not, we're case enthusiasts where we talk about it maybe on a podcast and then we kind of forget about it. We look at a few videos and we're kind of done with it. But there's a handful of people that may have went crazy and studied every single aspect. I think like producer Brenda.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, got every little thing from every file. I mean, a few people like that, but you don't know the full story just because you think you know the full story.
No.
You just don't.
No. And so, and be honest.
Yeah.
You
exactly.
You know that most of what you know came from Making a Murderer season one and season two.
100%.
If you're honest.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, like you said, there's small handful. Very small handful.
Yeah.
But the comments on every video I've watched or our own video is not a small. I mean, there's a ton of people who are like savants when it comes to this, they think. I'm telling you.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there's a handful of, this has changed my mind. I think he's guilty, or I always knew he was guilty. There's definitely some of those.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority of, and not just our video, but all the ones I've watched.
Me too.
I like to read this comments. Doesn't change anything. I knew all this stuff. No, you didn't.
No, you didn't.
You didn't know all this stuff.
No way.
You didn't know how they edited it because you would have to be their friends and be part of their process to know how they edited
That's
it.
That's right.
You just can't. And yeah, again, you could go get all the records and whatever and the whole entire transcript of the whole trial. You can't know all that stuff from reading thousands of pages on paper in this
and have a life.
Knowledge. No, not, and have a life.
Exactly. Yeah. And you're not going to hear Colburn's side.
No.
You're not going to hear the voicemail messages he plays.
And you're not going to be watching like the documentary and reading the transcripts of the trial and then putting them side by side and realizing they took this whole chunk of information out.
Right.
You can't, you're not going to do that.
No, you're not. That's right.
You know, so it doesn't matter if you have the full case file. You can't, you're not going to be comparing those to know, okay, they conveniently left out that whole paragraph of Colburn saying this or answering that or whatever it may be.
Yeah. And
so,
did you know that they used that one shot of him three times?
Yeah.
Where he's
not
even
talking.
Can't know
that because that's not in the case file.
Right.
So those things are what we're talking about. You know, it's not just the evidence and the case and all that you know, the legal stuff. It's the editing. It's the producing and all that good stuff as far as the documentary itself.
It's things that matter.
And they do matter.
It makes
it, because that's what gives you, that's what pulls on your heartstrings and makes you think one way or the other. So that's all we're doing. We're trying to present both sides. And, you know, again, there's still shit the cops fucked up on for sure.
Yeah.
I still have, like you said, trouble with Brendan. But,
Yeah,
we're just trying to just tell both sides of the story and just have a conversation. So
that's right. And just stay tuned.
Mm-hmm.
Stay
definitely
tuned to us as well, because we'll keep talking and we'll keep thinking. You know, this is something you have to digest.
You do.
It takes time to like really said, step back from it.
You've already watched them a couple of times. I will too, because there's things that you got to think about. And like, let me go back and see that thing again.
Actually, a matter of fact, I can say this much. After what I watched last night, when I watched the episodes 8 and 9, I was sitting there going, those bastards need to rot in prison. But then I told Chris, I said, I had this mindset. Okay, fool me once, shame on me.
Right.
Fool me twice. No, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me. I'm George Bushing it over here. Not, won't be fooled again.
Oh my God!
Okay, let me.
Yeah, dude.
I said, "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me." What I meant was, I came away from Making a Murderer so freaking mad.
Same.
And then I come away from Convicting a Murderer feeling the same feelings.
Yeah. And so,
I need to step back for a minute and digest this. So try to do that as well.
Yes, it's because, again, it's the same thing. You can all of a sudden switch, and you're being kind of pulled this direction, and then you're ignoring anything they said in Making a Murder, which that's not what we're saying either.
Right.
Just both sides of the story.
Just both sides. And just be open-minded.
Yeah.
And breathe.
It's crazy, man.
It's a wild ride.
And breathe, it is. But anyway, that's basically wraps up episode 6 and 7. And again, stay tuned, man. We got something cool coming, and then we'll definitely be talking about, the rest of the episodes when we can. And I think that's good. Anything else? I'm sure we're going to think of something.
I can't believe that George Bush that.
Yeah. Well, that's all right. We have to have some funny moments otherwise.
That's right.
Podcast.
That's right.
Especially after losing the first 30 minutes the first time.
Yeah.
I think we covered it all again,
though. We just filmed 1.5 podcasts.
We did. This fucking old file was corrupt. Jesus. But anything else?
No. Good? I feel good about
it. I'm sure there'll be some little thing we forgot to mention or whatever. We'll go, oh, damn. But I'm sure we'll hear it in the comments. But yeah, let us know what you think.
Yeah.
Have you watched it? Have you changed your mind at all? Is it, at least giving you at least a little retrospective of how this whole thing was put together and the legal system in general, and then conspiracies, you have to have all these people involved and everybody's got to, have the same goal and work together and not get caught. And it's just a crazy roller coaster ride. But again, just remember Teresa Halbach, she actually got killed during this.
Yeah, that's right.
We're all kind of profiting from this story in some way.
Yeah.
But
I think when this is all said and done, they ought to let Stephen Avery and Joe Exotic fist fight.
I agree.
Whoever wins gets out.
Oh, she gets out. Okay, I was going to say to the death. But that would be the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there pretty you much. That would be cool.
That's right.
That would be entertaining. That would be pay-per-view that people would watch.
It would.
Anyway. So stay tuned. We'll be back next week with something very special. And then we'll continue the week after that as well with the other episodes. So I guess we'll let it go. And thanks for watching, and let it fade to black. My voice is cracking.